We're delighted to have the CEO of the LA Dodgers, Stan Kasten, with us as our guest this morning. This is a position for Stan that became a reality in late April of last year, 2012. But baseball people and really the sports world know Stan well for his franchise building of winning franchises over 3 decades. He began his sports career in the NBA when he became the youngest GM in NBA history at age 27 in 1979 with the Atlanta Hawks. In 1999, he actually became the first person to hold the title of president at the same time for 3 pro sports franchises: the Hawks, the Thrashers, and the Braves. And of course, all of you know he has a world championship with the 95 Braves, and the Braves and Hawks made a combined 30 postseason appearances, including 15 division titles during his tenure. And after baseball returned to Washington, D.C. in 2006, Stan became the president, and was so from 2006 to 2010. And he laid the groundwork to build the Nationals franchise into the powerhouse it is today. I'm not sure I expected we'd be saying that, but that's where it's evolved. Really incredible. And now his goal is to try to restore one of the storied franchises in the game, the Dodgers, back to its glory days. And he's off to a great start. So please welcome Stan Kasten.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So Stan, you grew up in, or you were born in Lakewood in South Jersey.
Yeah.
And having grown up in the same era or basically the same age, what were your favorite sports and favorite sports teams growing up?
Oh, I was very much a diehard Yankee fan. My parents were immigrants. They didn't know anything about modern professional sports. Thought then and until they passed away, their whole lives thought it was a waste of time. I'm not sure they were wrong. But the Yankees were the local team on TV back in the days. So you all won't know this, but there was a time when we only had 3 channels. And the Yankees were our team. So my earliest recollection was Game 7 of the 1960 World Series, the Mazeroski game. And, okay, we have a Pirates fan here. And I was 8, so that's when I started falling in love with baseball. And it was a fortunate time for me because my favorite team was in the World Series 5 years in a row, and I just assumed, oh, that's how it always works. You know, your team is always in the World Series, and turns out that's not quite the case.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, I grew up in the exact same age and in the same era, and you couldn't avoid being a Yankee fan.
Yeah.
It was impossible.
Yeah.
You know, later when you were at Columbia Law School, I saw that you played in the Jersey Summer Baseball League.
Yeah.
So what was that about, and what position did you play, and did you ever have aspirations of going beyond?
We all have aspirations, but the reason we're here is that we couldn't go any farther. I was an excellent third base coach for my team. I was an outfielder. The best player in that league, my 3 years in the league, was Denny Walling. This group would remember. And just several years earlier, we had produced players like Ed Halicki, and John Montefusco was probably the best player that came out of that league. So, you know, I just played baseball because I love baseball. Yeah. But at that point, by the time I got into college, it was clear I was not going to become the center fielder for the Yankees. So I was going to have to move on to other things.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, as you look back at your career, just 3 years out of law school, you became, you know, you were an MBA GM.
Yeah.
I mean, how did that work? What was that experience like?
Well, first of all, it was you have to have a unique owner, which I did, maybe the most unique ever in Ted Turner, and Ted does things like that, and look at his career. When he does something off the charts like that, it seems to work out. And he had just bought the Hawks. I had just joined the company earlier and was doing some in-house legal stuff for him. And there was one thing after another going wrong with the Hawks. And And so he fired the GM, and there was a friend of his that took over for a couple years. But that friend was retired and didn't want to do it long term. And they hired someone else before me, but that didn't work out. And after 3 months, that guy was gone. I was the only one left. And ta-da, Stan, you're a GM in the NBA. And so there wasn't a direct path to it. It meant, was I in over my head? You bet. And it meant I had to work extra hard, which I did, which, you know, no reason not to. And it kind of worked out.
Do you remember any of your early moves as a GM of the Hawks?
Yeah. Sure. We did a lot of things. I remember my first trade was a three-way trade involving Seattle and Utah, players that nobody would remember here. Jim McElroy and Ron Lee were, you know, it was complicated. But anyway, yes, I remember those. And it was intimidating because I didn't have any natural circle of colleagues. You know, I wasn't a former player. I hadn't even been in the business very long. So I had to build all that up while, you know, studying real hard on all the stuff I need to know.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you took over the Braves, you actually took over for Ted Turner, right?
Yeah.
Ted was your predecessor, your owner. And so, tell me about that.
Well, the Braves were the engine driving the train of TBS. You know, it's what made TBS a national station with great appeal. And because of that, the ad boys were going to Ted every year and saying, Ted, we've got to get a hot guy to sell our ads this year. And so the philosophy had been, let's get every year's free agent. And so for years, whether it was Claudel Washington or Al Raboski or Andy Messersmith, that was the MO. We're going to sign the free agent. And because of that, you know, they were never getting closer. They were getting farther because every year they'd sign a free agent and they'd just get worse. And by the time Ted asked me to take over the team, we were a last place team with the highest payroll in baseball, which is almost hard to do if you're trying to do it on purpose, you know. But that's a bad situation, and so I didn't want to do it because, you know, Ted's idea wasn't that I would do it instead of the Hawks. I was the GM of the Hawks at the time, and we had won some games. I'd won some awards, so he said, "Stan, your first love is baseball. Do this." But his idea wasn't take over instead of the Hawks. It was do it in addition to the Hawks. And I said, no, Ted, that can't be done. He said, no, you'll be great. You'll be the only guy running two teams. Isn't that right? And I go, yeah, Ted, do you know why that is? It's such a bad idea, you know? But he said, nah. And as I always say, you know, Ted and I had this understanding. When he and I disagreed on something, we just did things his way. And so that's how I took over. But after I'd spent 30 days analyzing the circumstance, I sat him down and I explained, you know, here's why. You know, we're spending all this money and we're getting worse, okay? Here's why. When you sign a free agent, if everything goes right, you get one great season out of one great player. That's if everything goes right. But here are all the things that can go wrong. He could get injured. You're blocking the way for minor league players at that position. You're giving up draft pick compensation. And so let's take that money and invest it in scouting player development and hire more coaches and hire more scouts and buy more minor league teams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe if you do that for that same amount of money, you get 10 players, maybe each of whom gives you 10 major league seasons. Now, that's a difference of 100-1. Now, it's not going to be 100-1, but you know, you get the point. Ted, it's just a much better way to go. And to his eternal credit, he said, I don't need lectures, okay? Just do it. And I say that because it's important, because owners will always talk about long-term plans, scouting player development, but you often see when the team loses two games in a row, people start getting fired, okay? That was not Ted Turner. Ted, when he wants an answer, he can be an impatient guy, but when the answer requires time, he can be the world's most patient guy. And he was, and so he allowed us to do things the right way for the long haul, and the result was the Braves were good and are good, have been for a very long time.
So in 1990, the Braves won, what, 65 games?
Yeah.
Next year, 94.
Yeah.
What was behind that transformation?
Well, I think we had spent, as I said, when I started, I told Ted, okay, the next 3-4 years, you know, we didn't have the internet. Thank goodness back then. We didn't have blogs back then. I would have been eaten alive. But I did tell Ted, talk radio, we had talk radio. I said, for the next couple of years, I'm going to be the village idiot every night on talk radio while we're building this up. And Ted could not care less. Ted is the most invulnerable guy to criticism I've ever met in my life. So yeah, we were bad, but we were building up, and we were building a terrific minor league farm system. And by the time, in the middle of 1990, when Bobby Cox agreed to go back into the dugout, I knew that the last piece was getting the right GM to make all the things that we had been working on fit, make it all go together and set the course for the future. And I was able to convince John Schuerholz to come from Kansas City, and things went pretty smoothly from that point forward.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard you say that one of the keys and foundations is both a strong farm system, player development, and a great starting rotation. Talk a little bit about those.
Well, what I say is if you have a great, stable, consistent, healthy rotation, anything is possible. And if you don't have it, nothing is possible. So that's what it boils down. Now, so if you have four aces, you know, you're gonna win all the time. If you have four zeros, you're never going to win. Now, none of us are at either extreme. So all of our teams are somewhere in between those two extremes. And that's where the fun begins, and that's why our competitive balance is so good. But that's what you shoot for. I think if you can somehow come up with that strong, stable rotation that doesn't miss starts, that is consistent in their performance, you're going to go pretty far. That's been my experience.
Do you see the game changing at all in the sense that can a great bullpen fill this gap, or does it really have to be still a strong foundation of
starts? Well, I think it starts. I mean, you need all 25 guys. I don't want to minimize that. And I'm particularly interested in the recent revival of platoons. You know, platoons were kind of a popular thing in the 50s, and we kind of moved away from it during the star era of the 80s, 90s, and we're back more into understanding the benefits of platooning now. So you need all 25 guys, but I would say over my time in the game, bullpens have become increasingly important because we don't see guys, you know, throw complete games anymore. That, you know, we introduced Sandy Koufax to our players 2 weeks ago in Glendale, and everyone knows who Sandy Koufax is. But Don Mattingly stood there and listed his accomplishments and the number of complete games that he pitched year in. His last two seasons in the major leagues, he had like 40 or some incredible number. This is as he was getting ready to retire. That era obviously is gone. And so now I think the game is if you're within 3 runs in the sixth inning, you're in the ballgame because now the fun begins. Now you start getting into your bullpen, which typically is not as strong as your rotation, and then there are going to be matchups and changes, and so it's a different game, and the bullpen has never been more important, that's for sure.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the Braves clubs of the string of the 14 straight postseason appearances and Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz and some of the other pieces of that and how it all came together and how much was that responsible for sustaining the success?
Well, it was way responsible for sustaining that success. What's most interesting to me about those years, I think it's maybe just an asterisk or a footnote or a coincidence, but it's interesting to me that all three were high school draft picks, okay? Mm. That's interesting. There's been a change in thinking recently, but that was the Braves focused on building their staffs and their organizations through heavily high school drafts. The other interesting thing about the three pitches, they were all acquired in the three different ways you can acquire a player. Tommy Glavine was a draft pick. John Smoltz was a player we traded for, and Greg Maddux was a free agent that we signed. So that was really interesting. You need all the tools. If you're just relying on a great scouting department, you'll be good, but you won't be as good as you might be if you focus on all of the avenues that you can have to acquire talent. The three of them were symbiotic in that they were best friends and extraordinarily competitive with each other. I mean, not just pitching. I mean, playing golf, playing ping pong, and all the stupid little games in the clubhouse. They were phenomenal at that, and it's kind of set the tone. And yet, you can't really have a pitcher be your team leader, because the guy's only out there every fifth day. And as strong personalities as we had in those three guys, none of them were really the team leader. Tommy was a leader because he was the National League player rep, and we had a lot of union stuff during those years. So he was out front like that, but he wasn't a clubhouse leader so much in rallying the troops. That has to be a position player. Or you could have a manager that sets a tone, and that's the other thing that we had. We had a unique personality, demeanor in Bobby Cox, who commanded respect, respected his players, and set a tone so that we didn't require a rah-rah clubhouse guy. We had people following Bobby, and that was a big part of our chemistry.
So what distinguished Bobby? Was he a great communicator? Was he forthright and straightforward with his players, more so than maybe the average manager? What made him that special?
I think, first of all, as a communicator, I think there are about 140 umpires who threw him out of games that don't think he was that great a communicator. But it's interesting, a guy like Bobby, who is so respectful of everyone, players, umpires, would still rise up and get himself thrown out because he thought it was part of the job. No, he was a guy who believes there is a right way to play baseball. Not the same way for every player, but there's a right way to play, a right way to respect the game. He would communicate through his coaches, which I think is a very effective way. I don't know that Bobby had a lot of sit-downs with individual players over the course of a year, and that's common among great managers. You need your coaches. You need your pitching coach to be a guru for your pitchers. You need your hitting coach to be a guru for your position players. And Bobby had a great group, a support group to do that. But again, it was setting the tone. It was respecting guys. It was knowing there's a famous incident where a very young Andrew Jones didn't hustle going after a fly ball, maybe the only one in his career I can remember. And Bobby took him out of the game in the middle of the inning to embarrass him. Mm-hmm. And that never happened again for Andrew Jones' entire career. But, you know, Bobby didn't have to say anything. It was just how Bobby believed you played the game, and I'm going to respect you, I'm going to give you a lot of latitude, and I'm always going to protect you by going out there and getting thrown out of the game if I have to. So that was the culture that we had in that clubhouse.
Interesting, yeah. When you joined the Nationals in 06, one of the first things you said was you vowed to build a farm system. And the results were pretty impressive. 2007, you got Detweiler and Jordan Zimmerman. 2008, Espinoza and Lombardozzi. Of course, 2009 was Strasburg and Storen, both in the first round. But also Nate Karns in the 12th round, who's on their 40-man today and could be a factor. And then, of course, in 2010, before you left, Bryce. So talk a little bit about, you know, what was behind the success. And obviously, you had some very early draft picks, but beyond that.
Yeah. Look, it's not, you know, it's not a secret formula. I believe you build baseball teams, and those teams that have sustained success are built on the foundation of scouting and player development. And every team that has ever had sustained success, I think, has done it that way. That requires a great front office staff and great scouts and great tools, you know, which more and more include analytics behind scouts. And that's it. And then guys who are willing to accept the goal of building a world championship team through their efforts. I think they have a terrific front office in Washington. I think they're led by a terrific GM who is very much a scout, very much a scouting backer, very different from a John Schuerholz. Okay, I needed different things, but they're both outstanding at what they do. And Mike Rizzo came over with a real ethos about scouting and built up a staff around him that produces quality year in, year out. And yes, I think they're a very good team, and the most interesting thing about that team is how much of that team is homegrown. That makes it... It makes it good, it makes it affordable, also makes it better for fans, because there's nothing that fans love in any sport more than young talent. And when you have a farm system that is touting guys a couple years ahead of time, fans can feel the anticipation and feel like they're growing up with these kids, it's a little bit of extra benefit for fans. So that's a team that's very good, and I think the fans are looking forward to a very exciting year.
Yeah, you're right, though. That continuity, the opportunity to follow a player through his minor league career into that 6 years of control, just is a big difference between bringing someone in for 3 years as a free agent. It's a huge difference. I learned recently that prior to the purchase of the Dodgers, you had given some thought and started to look into the purchase of the Astros.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that process.
Well, when I left Washington after the 2010 season, I had a lot of calls and expressions of interest and inquiries. Would you consider this? Would you consider that? And right at that time, as I was deciding what to do, the Astros, and I was looking at all sports. And I was advising people and doing some consulting, and so I was examining opportunities in all four major sports. And the Astros were on the table publicly for baseball. And I thought that was a very interesting opportunity, which it really was. Fourth largest city in America, fourth largest market, the largest market in America with only one team, about to kick off a brand new RSN that they own a significant piece of. So there are a lot of upsides. Now, what was clear was they were going to need a rebuilding job, and I thought that was going to require a tearing down and then a building up, very similar to what they're doing now. I think they're doing a terrific job. And I got to give a lot of people credit there, because they've had, frankly, more nerve than I might have had in just going, 100 miles an hour in their direction. They've decided to strip it down and build it all up without wasting a lot of time in the interim. And that takes a real commitment from ownership and understanding of what the process takes. So I give them a lot of credit, and I think they will be good in time. So we looked at that very hard because of all the things that I talked about. By this point, I had decided to do this with the Guggenheim people, with Mark, who is Mark Walter, who's a passionate baseball fan, a Cubs fan, and we were evaluating the opportunities. But it was midway through this that the rumbles about the Dodgers becoming available were starting to bubble up. And Mark and I both agreed that, look, if that day ever came, that the Dodgers were available, that would literally be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And so we were going to put everything else on the back burner and just wait that out to see if that really was a possibility.
Yeah. You mentioned the approach the Astros are taking now and how they've really gone into a sort of a headfirst dive to bring this thing back.
I don't like the word dive, okay. but I know what you're saying, yeah.
So the question is, I've heard two schools of thought. One is, we want to retool, but we don't want to draw, we don't want to allow the team to, I don't know what the threshold is, maybe sink to a 100-game loss season. So we want to manage that. So we want to do this over a longer period of time versus the approach they're taking, which is, look, we're going to do our best on the field every night, but we're not going to keep an asset who's not going to contribute to a winning season. We're going to turn that asset and refuel with it. Do you have a buy? Obviously not in that situation.
I think they've had the fortitude to do it the right way. And the key is you can't do the second thing, go all in on it while still pretending and telling your fans, oh, we think we're going to be really good winning this way. They're not doing that. They're not fooling anyone. They're telling the world exactly how they're going about it, that they have a plan. And it gets much easier for fans to understand. And they're even saying, look, if you don't want to support us in this interim, we get that. We understand. But we're telling you what we're doing. We're being open. We're being forthright. We do have a plan. Here's what it is. And I like that approach. Mm-hmm. I like that's the only way to do that. So I give them a lot of credit. And like I said, I would not be surprised if they're very good much sooner than people think because of that.
Yeah. Interesting. So now let's shift to the Dodgers. You started your investigation of what the Dodgers would be like to own, what the revenue and financial opportunities were. You had your group already assembled. You're not going to tell me that you anticipated paying $2 billion for the franchise when you got into this process.
No, I'm not going to tell you that. That would be a lie. But when we dug into the due diligence, got the numbers, did an awful lot of homework, did an awful lot of analysis with people who do this kind of analysis every day for a living, and have been very successful at it, Mark, Todd, all their colleagues at Guggenheim. This is what they do, and they appreciated the upside that we could realize in a market like LA. Let's remember the elements of what we were buying. We were buying an iconic global brand that was a little down on its luck in recent years in the second largest market in America and the media and entertainment capital of the world. When its TV rights were about to expire at a time that rights fees are exploding. All of those things were what we were buying, and we went through our decision making and reached the conclusion that because of all those factors, if we do our job, if we build the team correctly, then there'll be a return to us because of the size and strength of our market and all those other factors, from ticket sales and from sponsorships and media and all of this. And frankly, we feel even more confident about that decision today than we did at the time we made the final bid.
From what I can see, the fan responsiveness has been tremendous.
Off the charts, and I could not have predicted that because it takes a while to build up. Now, it helps that we had an extraordinarily loyal fan base through 50 years of passion. But last year, opening day, we were at 17,000 season tickets, and we were hoping to start building that up. Well, by opening day this year, we're going to be north of 30,000
wow.
season tickets. And for a fan base to turn around that quickly, it's very gratifying to us. And for fans to give us that vote of confidence before we've accomplished anything is very rewarding, and we're unbelievably appreciative of that.
Well, that's tremendous. Talk a little bit about, to the extent you can, or tell us what you can, about where you're going from a broadcast standpoint as you go forward now.
Well,
such a big part of what...
Well, we don't kick off a new RSN, Regional Sports Network, till next year, 2014. This year, we're still with our partners at Fox, who have done a great job for us. We are going to start a Dodger-owned RSN. It will at least start out with largely, if not entirely, Dodger programming, which means you'll be able, if you're a Dodger fan, to finally have a place to go 24 hours a day for Dodger programming, both games, as well as talk, as well as other features related to the Dodgers. So if you're a Dodger fan, and we have a market that extends through about 20 million people, there are a lot of them out there. We think it's going to be very popular. It kicks off next year. We still have a lot of details to work out about all the systems that will be carrying it, and that isn't done, but we have a year to work out those details.
Sure.
But we did announce that we're going to have our own RSN, and we think it was a great decision for the Dodgers. We think it's going to be a great decision for Dodger fans, too.
Somewhat patterned and modeled after some of what Yes has done?
Somewhat, yeah. That's been a very successful model for the Yankees. There have been others. But the final configuration of all of it has not really been set yet. But, you know, that's a good example to follow.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your organization's aptitude and usage of analysis to make decisions. And how does your organization balance scouting and analytics? What role has analytics played? Is that changing with you now, as CEO?
I don't know that it's changing, but like with everything that we did when I came in, I had ownership support to just turn the dial to the right on everything, on stadium experience, on payroll, on hiring scouts, and it's the same way with analytics. Now, I have not yet completed my first year with the team. So since baseball is an annual cycle, I'm still learning things, seeing new things. This is my first spring training, so I'm seeing things here about how we conduct ourselves. Analytics falls into that. I knew pretty early on that we needed more scouts and the best scouts that we could find, so we did a lot of that last summer. And I feel the same way about analytics. We do a good job. I'd call us middle of the pack. I want to get to the top of the pack. So we are looking into systems acquisition, hardware acquisition, and also more people to do a lot of that. Now, personally, if you ask me my personal opinion, I'd say I'm probably 60-40 scouts versus analytics, in if you can even quantify that. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason that I got to that position. That's where I am, but I want the best of all. I want the best scouting reports I can have, and I want the best data and data interpretation that I can have so that we can make ultimately the best decisions.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the the things going on today in the analytics world that keep you at that 60-40 or 40-60?
Let me say this. I think certain analytics are better in certain circumstances. Let me give you an example. I think that I say I'm 60-40, and I mean that when it comes to like player evaluation and making decisions on players. I'd be different if you asked me about game situations and game simulation. I think statistics are a heck of a lot more valuable, more reliable, more predictive in game situations. And I think that has intuitively been the case because for as long as I've been in baseball, 35 years or so, managers have been using platoon splits. You know, they've always, you know, primitive stats, you know, just like that. And now there's a lot more of that. But that's because in game situations, you know, the same situation is going to come up 100 times, 1,000 times. And so if you tell me that there's a 65% likelihood of outcome A versus outcome B, then I'll choose outcome A because I know over the long haul I'll be right. And contrast that, and these are the inherent limitations of statistical analysis. All statistics are flawless at explaining what just happened, but not entirely flawless at predicting what's about to happen. So that's an inherent limitation. And when I'm making a player evaluation, yes, statistics might be able to spit out what's 65% more likely versus 35% more likely. But I don't get to make that decision 100 times. I get to make it once. And for that, I need scouts to tell me, is this decision in the 65% bucket or is it in the 35%? That's my non-scientist, non-engineer way of explaining how I reach that in my decision-making.
Yeah, that's fair. Before we open it up to questions, I'll ask you one more, and that is, are there any areas today of measurement that you think need improvement in the game?
First of all, I've done 1,000 speeches and sit-downs like this. I've never been more intimidated than speaking to this group here today because I know, or I feel it, every single statement I make, someone's going to jump up with 12 different reasons why I'm wrong, and they have data to back it up, okay? So, but I'll bet you everyone in this room thinks the Holy Grail remains getting better at defensive measurement, okay? We still haven't quite figured that out. We've got a lot of theories, and everything we get is better than what we used to have, but we ain't there yet. And if someone in here thinks we are, then I need to see you and see what new system you're using. Because that, I think, there's a long way to... In basketball, I could measure defensive results because there's a much more direct relationship between the mistake you make and a basket that a guy scores. Mm-hmm. It's not that way in baseball. And so it's just harder. Much bigger field, more players doing many different things. So that's the Holy Grail for me, a reliable defensive measurement and what it all means. But, you know, we're so far ahead of where we were 10 years ago. And I know next year there's going to be new stuff coming out, and I'm looking forward to it.
That's terrific. Questions, please. Start with Dick. Wait for the mic, Dick.
Be gentle, Dick.
Oh, actually, this may be, I don't know. Going back to the big transition in Atlanta, from doormat to, you talked about, to league powerhouse, at least according to some defensive metrics, one of the big things that happened was you got guys like Pendleton, Bream, Belliard, Nixon, and the defensive efficiency of the team just, that really, in a way, drove the success of the mound and so forth. So my question is, was this something you guys sensed at the time?
Oh, no question about that. That's a great observation because it's exactly true. We got that one offseason between 90 and 91, we added Bream and Belliard and Pendleton and got Otis Nixon. Now, magically, also our pitchers got better. Can you imagine that? Yeah, that's how that works. You know, and all of a sudden we were a team that hadn't produced a pitcher in 20 years to now we couldn't stop producing pitchers. That was definitely a conscious decision by our incoming GM, John Scherholz, but it was also consonant with the plan Bobby and I had been discussing leading up to that year. But there's no question about it. That was and remains a really good thing to do. You want to help your pitchers? Get better guys to catch the ball. That's for sure.
Right here.
We had a great talk yesterday from Brian Kenny on the idea of changing the perspective on how the game is played, and you talked about liking that Platoon is coming back. And he had mentioned, you know, statistically speaking, relievers are throwing better. The batters only see him once. And he was thrown out the idea of going to like a full platoon pitching situation where you never see a batter a third time. And I was really interested to see, because he talked about like reticence to break the mold, because you break the mold, you get judged a lot harsher for failing than if you fail within the mold. What you thought about that, about new and maybe a little more experimental takes on that sort of playing the game?
You know, well, first of all, speaking as a guy who just spent a lot of money to get another starting pitcher, I like your idea. You know, I think using more relievers and fewer starters, maybe that's a way to go. I don't see it happening this year or next, but listen, those things happen over time. And you know what it will take to change is one manager and one GM believing in it and doing it and having success. And within 2 years, everyone will be trying a variation of that. That's how it works. That's how changes are made in our sport. The only thing that hasn't caught on like that is the occasional time we see in the National League someone bats a pitcher eighth. That has not caught on, okay? But I like the motivation behind things like that. But as I said, it's only going to happen when some team really does it and has success with it.
John?
Yeah, hi, John DeWan, Baseball Info Solutions. Two really quick things. First of all, we can measure defense now, so I just wanted to throw that out there. There's been a lot of people talking about not being able to measure defense. I think we have a very good handle on it.
And your stuff is as close as there is right now. I completely agree.
It's been a, you know, in the last 10 years, it's come a long way. But I wanted to throw something out there that you said. You're in a room full of analytical geeks, right?
And scared to death. Yeah.
We really love the analytics. But I have to tell you, I 100% agree with your stance regarding scouting and analytics. 60% scouting, 40% analytics. We know our place. Our place is simply to add to what's out there and add to what scouts bring. They are extremely valuable. So it's that blending of the scouting with the analytics that we believe in this room that is important to really understanding what's happening with players and predicting the future about what players can do.
John, let me tell you that one of my favorite GMs of baseball, who's very smart and very successful, says to me he really, really likes analytics when it completely supports what his scouts are saying, you know? Okay. When it doesn't, he's not so much into them. But you know, most of the time, I'm really 80%, 90% of the time, analytics do back up what our scouts are seeing, and that's kind of comforting. It's the 10 or 20%, which, by the way, can make all the difference, that you have to dig in and evaluate why is there this dissonance between what the data is showing you and what the human subjective stuff is showing you. So, and that might still be the thing that separates good teams from less good teams.
Over here.
You talked about how building a starting rotation is important to building a team.
A little more volume on the mic, or speak into it more.
You said that building a starting rotation is crucial to have a good team. Anything is possible if you have a good starting rotation. As we've seen recently, the role of closers and the saves, how a good closer can motivate a bullpen. Do you feel a good starting rotation can help make the bullpen better?
Well, I can. And by the way, there are some of you in here that will object to the notion of closers qua closers, right? There's that. Of course it can, by saving them innings. You know, but if you don't need your seventh, eighth, ninth inning guys, which increasingly we all have specialists for, if they don't need to go out every day or even every second day, that's going to make them a heck of a lot more valuable and effective, particularly in August and September and hopefully October. So, yeah, if you can get more and more, if you can get a starter who goes seven not to mention 8 innings, wow, that's a huge plus. It will make your whole staff better for sure.
Hi.
Yes, in the back, Wendy.
I have a question about the TV deal. There's been some information reported that there's been a dispute about how much of the annual rights fee is going to be included in the Dodgers revenue sharing pot. Can you tell us kind of where that stands and whether that deal is going to go forward kind of no matter what?
Well, all I can say to you for today is that we've announced we are going to have our own RSN, and there are a lot of details to work out. We've got the next year to do that, but I'm confident it will work out. I'm confident that starting next spring, you'll be able to see all the Dodger games on Sportsnet LA, and I'm really looking forward to it.
We have time for one last question, right here.
Stan, I'd like to get some insights based on your 35-plus years in baseball and as it shapes your philosophical thinking today. A little bit about defense and how that may shape your philosophy. So I'll ask you a specific, but yet it's a philosophical question. Is there, other than the pitcher, is there one position, or more than one if you feel a comment, that you could, where the fielding and defense is so good that you can tolerate as a starter 200, 220 average?
Yeah, and I'm gonna, you know, and again, most of you will agree with this because what I'm saying is kind of basic, but it's being strong up the middle. I need a great center fielder. My pitchers will tell you center fielder. I might choose shortstop before center fielder. And we might also agree on catcher. So if you ask me, it's up the middle, you know, and range. That's a big factor that pitchers tell me. They can feel a real value. They get more confidence when they have great range on a shortstop or a great range in a center fielder. And, of course, the catcher has to, you know, manage the staff. But I was blessed for all those years in Atlanta with a series of great outfielders, Andrew Jones, Marquise Grissom. You know, my pitchers never stopped talking about how it impacted their approach to the game. Greg Maddux did not feel bad about giving up fly balls in Atlanta. It didn't bother him a bit because he knew there was one guy that was going to go get everything, and that made a big difference. So I'd say it's shortstop. I think shortstop for me, but my pitchers might say center fielder.
Well, terrific. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Dan,
Vince. Appreciate it.
Thank you.